I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing the U.S. plot to assassinate Vladimir Lenin and install a Western-friendly dictator in Russia. What to make of this secret war, and why do so many in the United States not know about it? All of those questions and many more will be answered, hopefully, by Barnes Carr, a veteran journalist, who joins us on this edition of Parallax Views to discuss his book, The Lenin Plot, The Unknown Story of America's War Against Russia. If you're a history buff, trust me when I say this is an episode you are not going to want to miss. So, with that in mind, let's get right to the conversation with Barnes Carr, author of, again, The Lenin Plot, The Unknown Story of America's War Against Russia. Welcome to Parallax Views. Barnes Carr, author of the new book, The Lenin Plot, The Unknown Story of America's War Against Russia. How are you doing, Barnes?
Very well. Thank you. And thanks for asking me.
Well, I was really glad to get you on the show. And I found out before we started recording that you're a fan of the movie that this show is sort of named after, Parallax View. So that's always cool when I find a fellow traveler when it comes to that film. So in regards to this book, The Lenin Plot, before we get into maybe what led you to it and what The Lenin Plot was, let's talk about the sort of time period. What was happening leading up to the time that the Lenin Plot happened? What was happening in Russia with regards to the fall of the Tsars and the rise of Lenin? Let's get into that first.
Okay. This was the last year of the World War, 1917. It had been a long, expensive, bloody, unpopular war for Russia. Russia had enormous casualties. In 1916, the Brusilov Offensive on the southwestern Russian front, for example, that was Russia's last big offensive. Russia accumulated 7 million casualties in one battle. Now, that includes everything, dead, missing in action, captured, deserted, died from accident, illness, whatever. 7 million. I have never read of any battle since then that produced that many casualties, certainly not in World War II. I mean, they had thousands of casualties in World War II, but not 7 million in 1 week. So it was an unpopular war, and there was a lot of resentment against the Tsar because he was continuing it in an incompetent manner. Distrust led to demonstrations in January 1917 on the anniversary of the first Russian Revolution in 1905. And in numerous cities in Russia, there were violent protests, but that quieted down. Now, the next month, in February 1917, rioting broke out. The Russian Navy was the first to rebel. And then army barracks around Petrograd, which was the capital at the time, the old St. Petersburg. Uprising began in the barracks. And then the workers went on strike, and just one thing led to another. And finally, it got to the point that there were crowds in the street demanding a change. And they fought with the police. The Cossacks were called in to put down the rioting, and they joined the rioters. So it was a real mess, and it led to the czar being removed in a small military coup by his generals. They told him, you cannot continue like this. So he abdicated, and power was taken over by the Duma, the Russian parliament. They set up a Russian provisional government. The idea was that they would, they did call a constituent assembly for January 1918, almost a year later. And this constituent assembly would decide what kind of government Russia would have in the future, whether it was a constitutional monarchy like England, a pure republican form like France, or a federalist form like the United States. But at the same time that the provisional government was set up, a shadow government called the Petrograd Soviet was set up, led by Lenin. And they began immediately trying to stage a coup to overturn the provisional government. They tried first in June of 1917. That didn't get very far. The police and the Okhrana, the Tsar's secret police, found out about that and quelled it before it ever got off the ground. In July of 1917, there was an uprising by the Bolsheviks and an attempted coup at the Champ de Mars, the military parade ground in Petrograd. And it was put down by the army, which at that time was called the Russian Revolutionary Army of the Provisional Government, and the Cossacks. So things got quiet for a while, but Lenin kept agitating within his party, the Bolshevik party, to do something. And he got very frustrated because most of the entrenched Bolshevik bureaucrats really were kind of come see, come saw about the whole thing. But in October, he did organize an uprising that succeeded. It was he got together a mob of around, Trotsky said, around 400. And they laid siege to the Winter Palace in Petrograd.
Which and this is where, the October Revolution of 1917.
Right. I'm going to get into that and explain why it wasn't really a revolution. So they laid siege to the Winter Palace, and there was a lot of shooting going on. And the Bolsheviks finally turned off the electricity to the Winter Palace, but the lights outside stayed on. So the gunmen inside the palace were still able to shoot at Bolshevik targets. So finally, Trotsky ordered a gunship called the Aurora in the harbor to open fire on the Winter Palace. He had them fire six blanks. Well, that didn't do any good. So he ordered them to fire two live shells. And they hit the building, but Trotsky was Minister of War. Trotsky complained that the shells didn't do anything. They just kind of bounced off the plaster. And so he tried the cannon in the Peter and Paul fortress, and it was rusted and no use at all. So this mob invaded the Winter Palace, and the ministers surrendered. And with that, there was the transfer of power. Now, Trotsky said it was an uprising. It was a coup, a putsch. And a Bolshevik commander named Sukhanov was there, and he confirmed that. He said the exaggerated stories about this great heroic struggle were just that. They were exaggerated. He said all that night after the seizure of the palace, Bolshevik groups went from one installation to another, the post office, the army base, the navy base, things like that, and simply talked the employees into going over to the Bolsheviks. He said the suburbs slept through the whole thing. So it was not a revolution in the sense of a general uprising of the population. That had begun in February of 1917. Scholars and retired intelligence officers in Russia that I've talked to don't call it a revolution. They call it a coup or simply a seizure of power. But the way that Lenin got power was that the Bolshevik party was very small. Some figures I saw put them at about 600,000. And this was in a country where the European population was 103 million, I think. The largest party in the Revolutionary Party in Russia were the SRs, the Socialist Revolutionaries. They had around, I've seen various figures, around 6 or 7 million. The SRs represented the peasants. Lenin represented the workers in the city. Lenin knew that if he could seize Petrograd and Moscow, those were the two main cities in Russia. Almost everything noteworthy, military installations, universities, academic institutes, were centered in those two cities, the telegraph and telephone, all of that. If you control Moscow and Petrograd, even with a small force, then you had the country. And that was his theory. That's how he operated.
So when all of this occurs, what does this mean to the U.S. and other Western countries? And I guess that sort of leads us into what is or what was the Lenin plot.
Right. Well, when Lenin had cut a deal with Germany early in the war, around 1915, Germany wanted to get Russia out of the war so they could concentrate on the Western Front in France and Belgium. So they made a deal with Lenin. They supplied billions of German marks to Lenin and the Bolsheviks on the condition that Lenin would create chaos in the country, in Russia, and seize control. And that's what he did. And after he seized control, he would take the country out of the war. Now, he announced he was going to do that in October 1917. The Allies heard about this, and they just hit the ceiling, because they feared defeat on the Western Front if Russia withdrew from the war. So the main idea of the Lenin plot, it was a secret operation organized by the White House and the U.S. State Department to stage a coup in Moscow. By this, the capital was moved to Moscow in March of 1918, to stage a coup in Russia, assassinate Lenin, and set up a quote, dictatorship to install an Allied-friendly dictator in the Kremlin and get the country back in the war. That was the main idea. But there's also a humanitarian element. The Bolsheviks had just started murdering their opponents. When the provisional government took over, they granted amnesty to all political exiles, all political opponents of the Tsar's government. Lenin was having none of that. He wanted to eliminate all of them. So there was a military angle, a humanitarian angle, and also there was an economic angle, too. Some people in the United States felt that if the United States could get in a good foothold in Russia, then Russia, after the war, would be a big market for American consumer goods, automobiles, locomotives, blue jeans, sneakers, jazz records, the whole thing. So there were several elements, but the main thing was the military.
So what's interesting is there are certain reasons that this is known about in Russia and France and Britain, but it's really kind of a little known aspect of history, I think, for people in the U.S. Why is that? Does it have to do with a combination of factors? Or what's the reason that we don't know about this Lenin plot as much in the U.S.?
Well, the Lenin plot was a failure, and so was the accompanying military invasion of Russia. It was an undeclared war. It was the true beginning of the Cold War. If you define a Cold War as an attempt by one nation to defeat another nation militarily, politically, economically, culturally, without a formal declaration of war, that's a Cold War. And this was the true beginning of our 20th century Cold War, because the United States did not declare war on Russia, nor did France or Italy or England. It was an undeclared war. Lenin had never declared war on the Western Allies. He had never plotted to assassinate their leaders. The whole thing was a failure and was a big, big embarrassment to the Western Allies. Now, the French and the British still, they know, the general public still knows a good bit about this, because those countries still have an active interest in World War I. In this country, most people don't know very much at all about World War I. So the United States, because of this failure, they tried to cover it up. There was some media coverage of the plot, or mostly of the military invasion in 1918 and 1919, mainly in the Middle West, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, because those were the states that contributed most of the doughboys who went to Russia. But after a few months, the War Department and the State Department started blaming this whole thing on Russian propaganda. They were saying there's nothing to this. It's just Soviet propaganda. So the matter was kind of dropped in the media. They moved on to more urgent matters with the end of the war, the peace negotiations, the League of Nations. And the War Department, the State Department tried to sweep it under the carpet. The War Department would not allow returning veterans from Russia to get copies of their service reports. And the whole thing was covered up until the 1920s when some returning officers from Russia wrote a history of the American expedition fighting the Bolsheviki in Russia. And after that, several other veterans of the war wrote their accounts. Now, Roosevelt wanted to resume relations with Russia during World War II to open up an Eastern Front against Germany. So when he made speeches, he made no allusion to this. He said that the United States and Russia had been famous friends for 100 years. He just totally ignored the Lenin plot and the invasion. Now, Ronald Reagan did the same thing in the 1980s.
Well, he said, not to interrupt you, but I was going to say, even when we look at the Obama presidency and the Russian reset, I think there has been a desire to have maybe more diplomatic relations at various times between the U.S. and Russia, and maybe not talk about some of the bad blood.
Yeah, Obama tried briefly to reset relations. Trump tried briefly. Biden tried the other day briefly. And Putin, in effect, just hung up the phone on them. The Russians have never forgotten this. This Lenin plot and the invasion of Russia, which were, one was the military wing and one was the political wing of the Lenin plot. The Russians have never forgotten this. They've always thought that this was evidence that the West was out to destroy the Russian state. So, and that's why a complete reset with Russia will probably not be done anytime soon.
I was also going to, before, I didn't mean to interrupt you before, were you going to say something more about Reagan and how he sort of dealt with U.S.-Russia relations?
Oh, yeah. Reagan made a speech on television to the United States and Russia trying to reset relations, and he said, "Our sons have never fought one another in war." Well, that's not true.
Right, right. And this book sort of gives you the evidence of that. That's what's so fascinating about it. The next question I wanted to ask you is, how as a journalist did you, I guess, first come across this story? And then how did you approach uncovering this story, given how little is known about it here in the U.S.?
Well, I first found out about the military wing of the Lenin plot when I was a senior at Tulane. I met a gentleman at the library one day who had graduated from Tulane after what he called the First War, World War I. And he went to Paris in the 1920s and palled around with the Hemingways and the Fitzgeralds and that crowd. And he said he met some young American men who had served in our war against Russia. And I said, "Wait a minute, I've never heard anything about that." He said, "Well, you're studying creative writing, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, be creative. Do some research." Now, this was in the early days of the internet. Internet research was not very good at that time. So I had to go up to the library. Thankfully, Tulane has one of the largest Russian collections in the country. Their entire third floor of their library is all Russian. So I went up there and started doing research. And I found out a lot about the military wing through old newspapers and magazines from that period. Now, when it came to the political wing, a historian friend of mine, Richard Spence, whom you know, I think. Yeah, Rick's a grand old guy. You know, he's an expert on a number of these people who were involved in the Lenin plot.
Right. He wrote a book for my listeners that are unfamiliar. I believe it was called Trust No One, the secret world of Sidney Reilly. We'll get into Sidney Reilly a little bit later, but go on. Yeah. Yes.
Well, Rick said, mentioned Xenophon de Blumenthal Calamontiano. He was a University of Chicago graduate who was America's main street agent in Russia during this period. So I started doing research on Calamontiano, and it took a long time. I just had a lot of dead ends. And back then, you know, before emails were so popular, you had to write a letter to somebody, and that person had to write you back. So sometimes it took a month just to get a reply. So this went on for years. But slowly I accumulated information on the military wing and the political wing. At the same time, I was working on my first book, Operation Whisper, and that kind of slowed me down too.
So in regards to your experience researching for the book, did you have any specific experiences sleuthing around at the National Archives and having to navigate documents? Because I have a lot of listeners, especially younger listeners, that are getting into journalism and research.
Yeah.
And they always want to know about stories like that because I think it provides a useful framework for maybe how they can go about research and journalism.
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is the National Archives in Washington, Paris, and Kew, England, are very, very helpful. They'll answer your questions promptly. So is the Library of Congress. And I found a lot of help from the Hoover Institution at Stanford, from the University of Chicago Library, University of Michigan Library, Columbia University Library. Libraries and archives are very, very helpful. Now, the bad news is, even before the pandemic hit, they started having budgetary restraints, and they don't make copies of documents the way they used to and mail them to you. And a lot of the documents you're looking for are not digitized yet. So sometimes you have to hire somebody to go into the library or the archives and make copies of these and send them to you. And that costs money. But it's still cheaper than getting on a plane and flying to Washington just to check out one document.
So also in regards to just the research that you did for this book, and then we'll get more into the plot itself, I promise. Mm-hmm. There was a really interesting little bit you had in the introduction where you talk about having to put together the pieces of the puzzle, so to speak. And you mention this idea of the riddle of the Russian teacup and a Russian that you spoke to. And maybe you could explain, what is the riddle of the Russian teacup?
Well, I was a copy editor at the Evening Star in Washington, which at that time was the dominant newspaper. I was living in Georgetown, and there was a sports bar on Wisconsin Avenue where I used to go in the afternoons and drink beer and play the pinballs. And I started playing with this Russian guy. He's about my age, and he was friendly, and we started talking. And he presented himself as some kind of special consultant from Moscow, which I knew was a code name for KGB, and he knew that I knew, and it was kind of a joke between us. But he was telling me one time about the riddle of the teacup. It's an old story. It goes back maybe 100 years about it's a way that you, if you know how to use it, you can determine if a defector is telling you the truth. It starts off with the idea that you've got a pile of broken crockery. So you put them together and try to make something that makes sense. And those are the questions you ask your defector. But if you have a missing piece, then there's a big window of doubt as to his bona fides. Is he really a defector or is he a double? So he said, beware the broken teacup. And I tried to follow his advice. I put together the pieces of my teacup as best I could. There are still some avenues that would bear further investigation, further research, but I was on a deadline with this book and I just couldn't continue my research forever.
I think it's an interesting sort of anecdote, though, because it is really difficult at times putting together the full picture of these incidents in history, because sometimes we have little details and you sort of have to put them together and, you know, have to move them around a bit in order to get that bigger picture. So I think it's a very useful sort of anecdote.
Exactly. Yeah. The CIA now calls it connecting the dots.
So in regards to the plot itself, it's interesting. Yesterday I had a guest on. I was recording with a guest who was talking with me about John Foster Dulles of CIA fame, or Secretary of State. Alan Dulles was more involved with the CIA. But it was funny because the name Robert Lansing came up because I guess somehow Dulles was related familial-wise to Lansing. And he's a very interesting figure that is very pivotal to this book. So for my listeners who may be unfamiliar, who was Robert Lansing and why is he so pivotal to the Lenin plot?
Lansing was from a small town in New York. He got an appointment to the Wilson administration because he was active in the Democratic machine in New York State. He was a pacifist like Wilson. And he was kind of disappointed in that Wilson wouldn't give him a lot of responsibility. Lansing formed a habit of just sitting in cabinet meetings, doodling, and daydreaming until the Bolshevik coup. And that alarmed him and a lot of other people in the War Department, State Department, in the United States, England, France, Italy. And he suddenly saw that Russia was not going to get back in the war under Lenin. They had to replace Lenin, remove him. So he came up with this idea that the United States would go to South Russia and hire a Cossack army to stage a coup and remove Lenin and install a dictator friendly to the Allies. And he talked to Wilson about this, and he said, Lansing said, unfortunately, this is probably illegal because the Cossacks are not a recognized government. So what we'll have to do is send money to France and England in the form of war aid, and they will launder the money and send it to the Cossacks. So we have a money laundering operation here. And Wilson responded, "This has my complete approval." So it was Lansing and Wilson who came up with the first idea to get rid of Lenin. But they were going to do it in country, by an in-country army.
So I was going to add, this is interesting because President Wilson, he offers a very different stance in public, correct?
Oh, yes. He, in his 14 points, he encouraged non-intervention in the affairs of other countries, blah, blah, blah. That was all for public posturing.
So in regards to the main players, and there are many, many players that come up in the Lenin plot. I mean, this is like something out of, I don't know, a film noir movie plot. Who should we hone in on first? I think two of the really pivotal figures that come up early on are General Consul Pohl and Xenophon Kalamatiano, who you mentioned earlier. Who are these two men? And who did they report to, work under, and with the consent of?
Well, let me add first that this whole story reminds me of a novel written by Jimmy Breslin, who used to be with the New York Herald Tribune. It was called The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. So as the plot develops, you'll see what I'm talking about. So in Russia, the main conspirator was DeWitt Clinton Poole. He was consul, first consul, and then consul general in Moscow. His main street operative was Xenophon Kalamatiano. Kalamatiano went out and hired Russian and Latvian assets, set up spy networks, and rented safe houses. Overall, there was Ambassador David Francis. He gave them advice at every stage, and he forwarded their reports to Washington. So there was Francis, Pool and Kalamatiano. Those were the three main American players. Now, on the French side, the French worked the closest with the Americans in the street. They had been there before we got there. The French had. The French spies, starting at the top, we have Joseph Nulans. He was the ambassador to Russia. He was a hardliner against communism, against the Soviets. Also, the French people had lost 13 billion francs in war bonds when Lenin canceled all foreign debts. Nulons was said to be a grandiose personality who traveled with the glamour of a Raja. Below him was General Jean Lavergne. He was chief of the military mission, the French military mission in Russia. Now, he was there before the Calamantione and Poole got there. He tried at first to convince Trotsky to get the country back in the war. Trotsky was war minister, and Trotsky said no. So then Lavergne saw that an Allied invasion was the only way to go. So he sent agents out to look for landing sites for the Allied invasion. There was Joseph Fernand Grenard. He was consul general in Moscow. There was Marshal Marie-Henri de Vertemont. He was a French saboteur, an explosives expert. He slept with his explosive under his bed. He dressed all in black, black hat, black trench coat, black mustache. He chose the code name Monsieur Henri, which just drove Newlands up the wall. And then there was this is my favorite, Charles Adolphe Faupas Bidet. He had been a naval officer like de Vertemont. He had been with the Paris police in the Sûreté and worked the case against Matahari. He also arrested Trotsky at one time in France and deported him to Spain, supposedly to keep him from being arrested by the Okhrana, the Tsar's secret police. So why? That's the question. Did they have some kind of understanding that Bidet would help Trotsky, and then in the future, Trotsky would be a double agent for Bidet? We'll never know. We'll never know. But later on, Trotsky did save Bidet from execution in Russia, because that was a payback for that favor. Those were the main French agents. On the British side, we had Sidney Reilly. Sidney Reilly was a very mysterious character. We don't know exactly what his name was, or where he was born, or where he went to college. There are all sorts of contradictory stories about all this. We do know that he showed up in London with a lot of money and proceeded to establish himself as a Mediterranean gentleman in old London. He went to school, learned, took chemical courses, which would be good for forging documents. Now, Sidney had a reputation for being a con man, a trickster, a huckster, and he's suspected of murdering several people, including the husband of his first wife. But the SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, the British Secret Service, needed somebody they could send to Russia who spoke the language, who knew Russia, and who would be loyal to the Secret Service. The director was C. Cumming. He was having a lot of trouble hiring people because most of the applicants were graduates of Oxford and Cambridge, young gentlemen who dressed to the nines, and they just would not work out well as secret agents trying to infiltrate union halls and political meetings in Europe. So he was looking around for somebody, and Sidney appeared. Sidney applied for work. And so he hired Sidney and sent him over to Russia. And he was in charge of British participation in the Russian, in the Lenin plot. Reilly was told to simply go in and look around, assess the situation, and come back to London and report. But once he got there, he decided that the Red Army that Trotsky was raising was in bad shape. They didn't have boots. They didn't have guns. They didn't have ammunition. Didn't have uniforms. They were in bad. It was a ragtag outfit. He said that a properly equipped army could knock off these people and gain control of Russia. So that was his whole idea from the very beginning, to stage a coup in Russia. Now, the other agent, the next agent of note is Captain Francis Cromie. He was a naval attaché at the British Embassy in Petrograd, and he was also a naval saboteur. He had sunk several German and Soviet vessels. And the third British agent in the Lenin plot was Bruce Lockhart. Bruce Lockhart was sent to England, sent to Russia in January of 1918. The ambassador, George Buchanan, had been recalled to London because he didn't want to do anything about the Bolsheviks. So they recalled Buchanan and sent Lockhart in. But Lockhart was not an ambassador or a consul. He was a special representative of the Foreign Office. His instructions were to contact Lenin and Trotsky and try to get them back in the war. Well, he did that, but it didn't work. So he said the only way is to take over the country by force. So he joined the Lenin plot in the summer of 1918. He was the last major player to enter the Lenin plot. At the trial of the captured Allied agents in December of 1918, the prosecutor called this plot the Lockhart plot. But that was incorrect because Lockhart had very little to do with it. What they wanted to do was blame, they arrested Lockhart, and they wanted to blame everything on him because he was the senior British diplomatic officer in Russia. They wanted to use him to swap for Maxim Litvinov, who was Lenin's representative in London, who had been arrested for numerous charges and was being held in prison. And that's what they did. They traded Lockhart for Litvinov. But at the trial of the Allied spies, they called it the Lockhart plot. After that, the Russians started calling it the plot of the ambassadors or the plot of the envoys. So that was a very short-lived name.
It's interesting, too. I just want to, this is a little side note, since we were making references to how this could be a film noir, or maybe more appropriately, the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Exactly.
But what's interesting is I think Lockhart and Riley both serve as a bit of inspiration for Ian Fleming with the James Bond character.
Yes. Ian Fleming, in 1953, told an associate at the Sunday Times in London that he had based James Bond, 007, on Sidney Reilly. Well, yes and no. Later on, Fleming said there were other characters that entered into his into this character, and one of whom might have been Lockhart. The truth was, in all fictional characters are basically a composite of a number of people. But Reilly definitely would qualify as one of the prime suspects. He was a dashing gentleman. He dressed well. He traveled well, stayed in the best hotels. He was kind of a 007 character. But so was Lockhart.
Also, before we get into the details of the plot more, when it comes to these characters, some of them have some very unusual eccentricities. In particular, I think Xenophon maybe was the one that was a bit superstitious.
Oh, that was
him up.
That was Riley. Riley was a drug addict, and he had visions of himself as a reincarnated Napoleon who could ride in and save Russia. And he wrote in his memoirs, "Why not?" So he was, and also there was another very important Allied agent, a Russian named Boris Savinkov. Rick Spence wrote a book about him, too. Savinkov was an SR terrorist who had been blowing away and he had been shooting, stabbing, and blowing away Tsarist officials since the previous century. And now, once the Bolsheviks took over, he declared war on the Reds. And he was also a drug addict. He was the one who was very superstitious. He would not he always had to wear a certain color every day. And he would not go outside if it was raining and the sun was shining. And he believed that wearing silk underwear.
Silk underwear could ward off bullets.
Bullets, exactly, yeah. see, we got a whole cast of nut characters here. And they were all very sloppy in their tradecraft.
So, in regards to the details of the plot, and I know we can't get into every little detail. I mean, this is a lengthy sort of tome, over 400 pages. What are the main details, and why do you say that this plot is a lot like the gang that couldn't shoot straight?
Well, I went through the book last night and made a list of tradecraft errors that the Allied agents had committed. It begins with Riley. When Riley appeared in Russia, he was promptly detained by British authorities. They didn't think he was who he said he was. I mean, he said he was Russian, but he was using the name Riley. So they questioned him and searched him and found a coded message taped to the inside of a cork in his aspirin bottle. That was Sidney's main, that was his first tradecraft error. And also later on, he left a card with his name and address and his Moscow address at the home of one of the Allied assets in Petrograd. And a Cheka double agent found it and reported that back to Cheka headquarters in Moscow. So they knew exactly where to find Sidney. Now, Captain Cromie didn't properly vet a couple of Latvian army officers who approached him and said that they wanted to join the Allied plot. There was a Latvian military force in Moscow, which served mainly as palace guards at the Kremlin and also as executioners. And they were sick of their job and wanted to go over to the Allies. Well, unfortunately, these guys were double agents for the Cheka. And Cromie didn't properly vet them. He didn't check them out. Lockhart, too, didn't properly check out these Latvians. Cromie sent these Latvians to talk to Lockhart. Lockhart promised them money, but he didn't check them out. He just assumed that they were okay because Cromie sent them. This is one of the problems of this era when spying was a business primarily of gentlemen, and one gentleman believed what another gentleman said. It would be improper to question him. Also, Lockhart gave one of the Latvians a letter of transit so that he could go to Archangel in North Russia and meet with the Allied military force up there. Well, this Latvian was another double agent, and he took that letter of transit promptly to Cheka headquarters. But Lockhart's main sin of tradecraft was he's having an affair with a woman named Maria Benkendorf. She was a Russian of the old aristocracy. Her father had been a member of the Senate. She was kind of displaced after the Russians took over. They didn't want anything to do with the old aristocracy. So she bedded down with Lockhart, and she became his, quote, interpreter, although Lockhart was fluent in Russian. So she was privy to all sorts of British secrets. She also provided Lockhart with information. So that made her a British agent. But the Sûreté investigated her and found out that she was also an agent for the Germans and the Soviets. And that was one of the original accusations made against her by the Cheka. So that was a big, big tradecraft disaster right there.
So there's even, in other words, a sort of femme fatale character
exactly.
sort of film noir-esque story.
Yeah, yeah. That's why it would be a good film noir. And also, now, Calamontiano was fairly careful, except for one thing, and this was a big, big error. This was an error as big as Lockhart's. He kept his code book and a list of his Russian assets and the amount of money that he paid them rolled up inside his walking cane. So when he was arrested by the Cheka, they opened up the cane and voila. Also, Poole made a serious tradecraft error. He was talking to Chicherin, the Minister for Foreign Affairs. They were friends, and they were sitting around talking one day, and Poole happened to mention that Calamontiano was supplying him with business, quote, bulletins. Well, Chicherin didn't believe that for a second. Business bulletins? You know, that was a piece of the broken teapot. I don't know why Poole said that. And his memoirs didn't explain why he did that. But it was a major, major tradecraft error. And also Sabinkoff too was on drugs. His girlfriend was the wife of his secretary. Her name was Amy Derenthal. And she was helping us, ostensibly, she was helping Sabinkoff all during 1917 and 1918. But after he was arrested, there were accusations against her that she was also a double agent for the Cheka. So the whole plot was infiltrated from the very beginning.
Wow. It's a crazy story. And I wanted to go back briefly. You mentioned that for some, this plot, especially in Britain, has become known as the Lockhart plot. Bruce Lockhart wrote about it in his 1932 Memoirs of a British Agent. You're focusing more, though, on the U.S. role in the plot as opposed to the French and British roles. Why is that your approach? Because I know some people, I've listened to other interviews with you where some of the hosts were thinking that this was more of a British plot and a French plot, but from what you've seen, it seems that the U.S. is actually at the center of it.
Well, that's what the Jacob Peters of the Cheka said when he arrested the Allied spies. He told Bruce Lockhart that the Americans were the, quote, most compromised in this. I think the reason why that a lot of this, the Russians didn't mention the Americans a lot because they were hoping for American foreign aid after the war. They were in desperate straits. They were in famine. They had epidemics, pandemics, starvation. Millions were dying. They didn't want to offend the Americans. So they kind of glossed over that and blamed it all on Lockhart. But when I was doing research for this book, I found out that some Americans had written about the Lenin plot, but they had left out almost all information about the French and the British. And when I read about it in French and British publications, they had left out almost all information about the American side. So what I tried to do was write a balanced coverage of this from the American side, from the British side, from the French side, from the Russian side, and from the Latvian side. But the emphasis was on the American side because the book originally was a biography of Calamontiano, the American.
Before we wrap up here, how did the plot come to an end? I think you've given some reasons for why it failed, but what leads to the Soviets becoming aware of this plot and how do they react to it?
Well, they knew almost from the very beginning that the Allies were plotting against them. They had their sources, just like the Allies had their sources. Lockhart said that Riley said that in the summer of 1918, Lenin and Felix Dzerzhinsky, who was head of the Cheka, the Soviet secret police, got together and said, we've got to do something about this. So they set up a sting operation using these Latvian army officers as double agents for the Cheka. And they contacted the Allied plotters and set up their arrests.
So in regards to the sort of aftermath, what happens to some of the main players after this plot is unraveled, essentially?
Well, Calamontiano was put in prison. He was sentenced to death first, but then the Cheka wanted blood, and so did the prosecutor. They wanted to shoot him that night, but the diplomatic service primarily, Chicherin intervened and said, let's hold him for hostage for American aid, American foreign aid. So he was held in prison until 1921. The other plotters, Lockhart was swapped for Litvinov. The other allied plotters, Riley and Poole and Savinkov, all fled Russia, got away safely. Captain Kromy was murdered by the Cheka right after Lenin was shot. I think it was directly in retaliation for the shooting of Lenin. So most of them got away. A few of them were tried. Most of the Allied agents tried by the Cheka, and there were about 30 of them. Those were Kalamatiano's local assets. And some were, I don't think any were executed. Most were sent to labor camps or held until the war was over, or some of them were exonerated. But Kalamatiano and his main asset inside Red Army Communications, Alexander Fried, were sentenced to death. Fried was a Latvian and a secret anti-Bolshevik, and he was supplying secret reports to Kalamatiano and Riley, and they passed them along to the other British and French and American agents, and those reports were also sent to Washington by Ambassador Francis. He was executed that night. Fried was. It was a sad story. He was really a patriot.
You know, it's interesting because I didn't realize it earlier, but since we've mentioned it, the gang that couldn't shoot straight, I didn't realize you were talking about the novel, and I thought, is he talking about the movie that's based on the life of the gangster Joe Gallo? And it is based on that same novel. For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, why do you compare it to the gang that couldn't shoot straight? Because I just made the connection, the movie and the novel the movie's based on the novel.
Well, I didn't see the movie, but read the book. It was hilarious. It was a study in incompetence. These guys were klutzes. They were just stumbling all over themselves. And that's why I thought it's comparable to all these stupid mistakes that the Allied plotters made in Russia.
Now, before we talk about maybe the relevance of the Lenin plot today, is there anything we missed with regards to failures in regards to how the plot was carried out? Do you think we captured sort of everything that needed to be captured, like broadly speaking, of course?
Well, there's always the subject of the shooting of Lenin. The Cheka said it was done by identified her, the gunwoman, as Fanny Kaplan, a hardened old-line SR terrorist. And she was part of a gang that was stalking Lenin and Trotsky, looking for an opportunity to shoot them. They arrested Kaplan, and she confessed to the whole thing, but she didn't name any names beyond herself. And subsequent investigations revealed that the Allies were in the shadows around this. When Savinkov wrote his memoirs, he told his translator, Joseph Chaplin, that he gave Fanny Kaplan the pistol she used to shoot Lenin. So apparently, or I believe that was part of the Lenin plot, the shooting of Lenin. It just failed.
And what was the role of infiltrators when it came to this plot? Because there's a lot of double agents and things like that. And I don't think I mentioned that as much as I should have earlier.
How do you mean the role?
What role does it play in maybe compromising the plot, this role of infiltrators?
Yeah. Well, the Cheka infiltrators knew what the Lenin plotters were doing right down the line. And all this came to a head in August of 1918 when the main Allied plotters had a meeting with Poole and Kalamatiano in the American consulate in Moscow. And there was a French journalist who was allowed to, I think, new laws brought him in. Well, this journalist was present at this meeting where the spies made all sorts of plans. They were going to dynamite bridges and airfields and set up an assassination squad for Lenin. And he was appalled. He said he was appalled. And after the meeting, he contacted the Cheka and denounced them all and gave them a written statement, which was used in the trial of the Allied spies. That was the biggest example of an infiltrator, a mole, as they're called now.
So beyond being great fodder for a movie, and I do think this needs to be made into a movie at some point, what can we learn from the Lenin plot? You sort of referenced earlier that there's still distrust when it comes to Russia and U.S. relations. You know, Russia remembers this. So there's obviously things that we can learn from this today when it comes to spy craft, statecraft, foreign policy, diplomacy, beyond just maybe the fact that if we know our history, we can find that, oh, Russia may distrust us for this reason. Is there anything else we can learn from this plot that took place so many decades ago?
Well, first of all, if you're going to mount a plot this big, and this is the biggest plot I found in intelligence histories of United States, if you're going to do something like this, you've got to maintain airtight security. Security, security, security. You can't go around making stupid mistakes. And a lot of these guys just made stupid mistakes. They trusted one another. This was time of war. Expediency trumped trust. You can't do that. You can't trust anyone. I think they realize that now. And so far as most spying these days is done by surveillance. We have satellite surveillance, which records. Our system is called Echelon. It's a satellite surveillance system that vacuums in telephone calls, emails, faxes, television programs, radio programs from all over the world. And they've got an entire building full of people who listen to these recordings, listening for certain key words, key phrases. And there's also computer hacking. That's a big tool that's used now, which was not used, of course, back in the World War I period. False news, fake news, false intelligence, all that's used now. I interviewed a KGB officer from my first book, Operation Whisper, and he said, don't believe for a second that the Cold War is over. It's still going on. It's just different now. We're no longer fighting one another, the East and West, the way we did in Korea and Vietnam and Cuba and Africa. Now it's all information. It's an information war now.
It's interesting because I guess I mentioned the lessons learned aspect of the book because, you know, on one hand, this is a book that is just a really thrilling story. But like I said, there's also things that can be learned from it. It's instructive while also being a really exciting story that you can, you know, just, I mean, I breezed through the book because I just found it so gripping.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a combination of history, biography, and a journalistic, expose. A combination of all three. I was hoping that would be a good formula, and hopefully it was.
Now, we've gone for about an hour here. I want to thank you for your time, and I wanted to ask if you're working on anything coming up. I heard you have something in the works with regards to the MLK assassination.
Yes. Well, first of all, my agent, Andrew Lowney in London, has two novels that I've written. One is called Appointment in Moscow. It's a spy thriller set in revolutionary Russia. And the other one is Potomac Fever. That's a contemporary political thriller set in Washington. The newly elected president on inauguration night poisons her husband because he threatened to blow the whistle on one of her dirty tricks that led to the suicide of her main opponent. It's called Potomac Fever. Now, the next nonfiction I write, the working title is The Klan, the King, and Katrina. It's a writer's notebook, 50 years in the writing trade. I was a reporter. The King part comes in. I was a reporter for the Memphis Press-Senator in 1968 when King was assassinated. I was one of three reporters on the staff who was assigned to cover civil rights. So I covered the King assassination as best I could. There were still a lot of investigations going on, and we didn't know a lot about what was going on. I did the best I could, and then one day I got a call from a man named Bill Sartor. Bill Sartor had been city editor of my first newspaper job at the Delta Democrat Times in Greenville, Mississippi. It was a rather famous paper at the time. It was owned and operated by Hodding Carter, a Pulitzer Prize winner. Bill appeared in Memphis as a correspondent, an investigative journalist for Time Incorporated. Time Inc. published Life magazine and Time magazine. And his assignment was to investigate the possibility of a mafia connection in the King assassination. And he hired me as his chief researcher. So we worked on this for a long time. I interviewed witnesses, detectives, people who knew King, people who knew accused shadowy figures. It went on for a long time. We couldn't find anything definitive involving the mafia. So Bill left and went down to New Orleans, which was the center of mafia activity in the Gulf South. And he continued his research down there. And he died after a while, after a few years. And there was some question about his manuscript, the manuscript that he wrote. Time Life apparently turned it down for some reason. So I would be interested in finding that manuscript from surviving family members and find out exactly what he wrote about our research. But that's something that I'll be working on in the future. But the part about the Klan.
You almost got assassinated by the Klan, correct?
Oh, yeah. the gang that couldn't shoot straight. I was covering civil rights for the Delta Democrat Times and also as a stringer for the New York Herald Tribune. I was one of one, two, three reporters on the staff who covered civil rights stories. And I wrote a story exposing a local Klan member, and I also got a list of all the local Klan members. That in itself is a story. But I ran the story about this guy who identified him as one of the chief operatives of the Klan. And the story ran on Sunday in our Sunday paper. Monday morning, I came to work thinking nothing was wrong, walked to the newsroom at 8 o'clock. And Jan Robertson, our state editor, came over and stopped at my desk and looked at me. And I looked at her and she looked at me again. And I said, "What?" She said, "You have no idea, do you?" I said, "No, what happened?" She said, "They just got a call from the hospital, from the emergency room physician. He had just treated a man and his wife for gunshot wounds. And this guy told the doctor that he was coming over to the newsroom to get me," quote, "get me." But the problem was he got in his car with his wife. His wife was driving. She was going to drive to work and get out. And he would take the car over to the newspaper office and shoot me. Well, he was loading his revolver and it went off. And it shot him in the foot and her in the foot. So being a wise woman, she just turned around and drove to the hospital. So that was that. And I called the guy up later and interviewed him and said, "Why were you trying to shoot me?" Well, he denied the whole thing. And he told me a string of lies that I checked out. So that was the Klan assassination attempt. Again, it's the gang that couldn't shoot straight. There are so many of them out there.
I was going to say, we'll have to have you back on this program in the future when your next book comes out, because we didn't even get to cover. I know you have an interesting story about the capture of the Boston Strangler, stuff about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And I really want to have you on to tell those stories.
Well, I'll be glad to come back. I'll enjoy this very much.
Well, I want to thank you again, Barnes Carr, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners get a copy of The Lenin Plot?
Any bookstore or online service. My publisher in the U.S. is Pegasus Books. In Britain and the British Commonwealth, it's Amberley. and we're soon going to come out with a Bulgarian edition. Hopefully we'll get a Russian edition out soon. My agent, Andrew Lowney, is working on that.
Well, thank you again, Barnes Carr, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you, JG.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Barnes Carr, author of The Lenin Plot, The Unknown Story of America's War Against Russia. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Brian, Catherine, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.